Hi, welcome to the Growth Stop Me summary of the Obesity Code from Dr. Jason Fung. The Obesity Code is about a different approach to losing weight, not through cutting fat or calories, but through controlling our hormone, insulin. Dr. Fung recommends a low-carb, healthy-fat diet filled with whole, unprocessed foods, as well as intermittent fasting. Looking at the online reviews for this book, on Amazon, it has 4.6 stars, and on Goodreads, it has 4.4 stars. There were many positive reviewers who said the book helped them lose weight, and the main points are backed by science. But there were some critical reviewers who felt the ultimate advice was nothing new. In other words, you probably already know what to eat. Almost all diets work for losing weight. So says Dr. Jason Fung. In the world of nutrition advice, that's a shocking statement. Because usually, we hear nutrition experts arguing that one approach is correct. And if their way is right, the rest must be wrong and ineffective. So we hear arguments like low-carb versus low-fat, or vegan versus high protein, or cardio versus weightlifting. But according to Dr. Fung, scientific studies prove most diets do help us lose weight. The problem is that 6 to 12 months later, most people gain all the weight back. Why? Does it happen because of a lack of self-discipline or willpower? Well, maybe not. The Obesity Code argues that people remain overweight not because of a lack of self-control, but due to an imbalance in their hormones, specifically the hormone called insulin. Personally, I found many of the ideas in this book absolutely fascinating, because a lot of it goes against commonly accepted weight loss advice to simply eat less and move more. For example, Dr. Fung says counting calories and physical exercise are relatively ineffective at helping us lose weight. Now, growing up, I always heard that people were mainly overweight because they didn't run around enough. And don't even get me started on that food pyramid that they taught us all in school, telling each child that it's healthy to eat tons of white bread and pasta every day. Now, who is Dr. Jason Fung? Well, he's an MD, medical doctor, actually a nephrologist, which is a specialist in kidney diseases, who lives and practices in Toronto, Canada. As a young doctor, he noticed the most common cause of chronic kidney disease was diabetes, and the most common cause of diabetes was obesity. So over time, Dr. Fung switched his focus less on just treating the final symptoms of a disease, as he'd been taught in medical school, and more on treating the root causes of his patients' health problems, which was their obesity. In the beginning, he tried giving patients the usual dieting advice, but that didn't seem to work. Eventually, he found a different approach that did work, combining intermittent fasting and a diet of low carbs, healthy fats. So let's begin with lesson one from this book. Low fat was wrong. Warnings against saturated fat accidentally accelerated the obesity epidemic. From the 1970s until very recently, eating healthy was all about eating low fat. That was largely because of Dr. Ansel Keys, who conducted a famous 7 countries study where he found a correlation between eating more saturated fat and heart disease, and that led to something called the diet heart hypothesis, which said that eating more saturated fat causes high cholesterol, which causes heart disease. That means eating too much butter would supposedly cause our arteries to get clogged up, with cholesterol, kind of like a dirty pipe. Now, Dr. Ansel Keys was not against all fats. He was actually a promoter of the Mediterranean diet, which includes healthy unsaturated fats, like those found in olive oil, nuts, and fish. And the Mediterranean diet actually continues to be highly recommended today by top health authorities for a healthy heart, brain, and long life. However, the general public forgot those details, and it took home the simple message that fat equals bad. And they also began believing at some point that low fat was also good for losing weight. And because people were eating less calories from fat, they wound up eating more calories from other foods, such as refined carbohydrates. Adding fuel to the fire, in 1977, the US government published the Food Pyramid, which basically taught the foundation of a healthy diet was 6 to 11 daily servings of carbohydrates, including refined carbs like bread, cereals, and pasta. So over the next 25 years, people listened and ate up to 10% fewer calories from fat, but during the same time, obesity rates shot up from 15% to 35%, so it didn't appear to work. But what went wrong with the low-fat strategy? Well, here are a few key points that Dr. Fung explains. There was no real scientific evidence from the beginning that eating saturated fat causes more heart disease. Dr. Ansel Keys did find a correlation, but that isn't proof. His data could have also shown a strong correlation between heart disease and eating more sugar or animal protein, for example, but for some reason he chose not to emphasize those connections. More recent studies suggest the source of the saturated fat seems to be important. For example, whole fat dairy may reduce risk of heart disease, but processed meats could increase risk. According to more recent studies, there's no reduction in heart disease from a low-fat diet. In fact, replacing saturated fats with refined carbohydrates seems to increase our risk. And many doctors now believe heart disease is caused not by clogged arteries, but by inflammation. And that may be fueled by a diet higher in refined carbohydrates and sugar. So there were many unintended consequences of that low-fat advice. Big food companies jumped on the trend, marketing their highly processed foods as being low-fat. But when they removed the saturated fat, they had to add other ingredients to compensate and for the food to have taste. So they added more sugar, highly processed oils, and worst of all, deadly trans fats. Also, according to multiple recent studies, people seem to lose as much weight or more on low-carb diets as they do on low-fat diets. And that was a very confusing result to many people when those studies came out, because the public had been hearing for years that if you wanted to lose fat and be healthy, then you should eat low-fat. Along the way, there were some prominent voices who spoke against that overwhelming majority opinion, including Dr. Atkins, Dr. Bernstein, and the journalist Gary Taubes, but the authorities were quick to label them as fad diets, unproven, or even dangerous, even though the official recommendation of low-fat had little scientific proof and was basically unheard of before the 70s. Dr. Fung says that health recommendations can often stick around for a long time because people are reluctant to change past beliefs, even health authorities who are supposed to be more scientific. Psychologists may call that phenomenon cognitive dissonance. As an example, the recommendation to cut down on dietary cholesterol, like in eggs, that was only just retracted in 2015 in the US, when authorities finally admitted there was no scientific proof dietary cholesterol, increases blood cholesterol, but that took decades. Now, if you're interested in diets high in healthy fat, then you may have also heard of a Dr. David Perlmutter, who's a neurologist who's written 6 New York Times best-selling books. In his most popular book, Grain Brain, he argues that brain diseases, like Alzheimer's, are caused by chronic inflammation, and the inflammation is stimulated by a diet high in refined carbs, sugars, and grains. To protect our brains, Dr. Perlmutter recommends a diet similar to the Mediterranean diet with plenty of healthy, unsaturated fats from olive oil, avocados, nuts, and fish. But he goes a big step further, arguing that we should also stop eating whole grains, not just refined grains, but also whole grains, which is a position most health organizations would disagree with today. But is it possible that he could be right? If you want to hear that point of view, take a look at our summary of Grain Brain on growth.me. But to summarize the first lesson from this book, in the 1970s, Dr. Ansel Keys found a correlation between eating saturated fat and heart disease. Soon the public largely believed that eating fat would clog their arteries and make them obese. Large food companies began marketing low-fat food that was instead filled with sugar and refined carbs, ironically accelerating the obesity epidemic in all likelihood. Today, Dr. Feng says there's good scientific evidence that saturated fat does not increase risks of heart disease or obesity at all. And now to lesson 2. Low calorie is mistaken. Telling people to eat less doesn't work because it misses the ultimate cause of obesity. The official advice for losing weight can be summed up as eat less, move more. Eat fewer calories, do more physical exercise. It sounds reasonable, so why does it seem to fail for so many people? Well, the officials don't have much answer for that question, except maybe that people are too weak or lazy to follow the advice. Now, according to Dr. Feng, cutting calories does not work because it's a flawed strategy to begin with, because it's based on nutrition myths. I'll run through 3 of these myths that he talks about. The first myth is that fat equals calories in minus calories out. This is something many people believe because it sounds logical and intuitive. But it is a myth because when we reduce our calories in, then the calories coming out of our body are also reduced. Many studies have backed this up. You see, most of our caloric expenditure happens during ordinary day-to-day life, as our body generates heat, digests food, creates new cells, etc. That's called our basal metabolic rate. And when we significantly cut calories in, then our body believes that we're starving and need to conserve energy, so it reduces calories out by cutting down those essential processes, which is why people on a diet tend to feel cold and tired all the time. The second myth is that a calorie is a calorie, or that all calories are the same. You see, many people believe that weight loss is all about eating fewer calories, and it doesn't matter what kind of food you consume, whether it's broccoli or Twinkies. That's a myth, because different kinds of food are differently metabolized in our body, that's processed in our body differently. As an example, a calorie of Coca-Cola has much different effects in the body than a calorie of avocado. The Coca-Cola contains sugar that stimulates an increase in blood sugar, blood glucose, which then increases our insulin levels, which is a hormone. So there are all these processes in our body that can have a large impact on our weight loss. And a third myth is eating less is about willpower. That's a myth because it's actually hormones that control important things like our level of hunger, fat storage, etc. For instance, obese people have higher levels of a hormone called leptin, produced in the fat cells. Leptin communicates with a part of our brain called the hypothalamus, which then controls our appetite. But Dr. Fung says leptin is only a secondary mechanism in obesity, so we'll talk about the primary cause in just a minute, but it's a simple example of how eating less has to do with all these different processes in our body, not only willpower. Basically, Dr. Fung says that calories are not the controlling factor in losing weight. They're only a secondary factor. It is hormonal processes that ultimately control the amount of calories we intake and expend. Now, if that sounds unlikely or far-fetched, consider this. In the 1960s, there was a Dr. Ethan Sims who conducted several experiments trying to make people gain weight through overeating, and he found it was surprisingly difficult for many of his subjects to gain weight, even eating 4,000 calories per day. When the subjects did gain weight, it was far less than was predicted by the calorie model, and they would usually lose the weight very quickly after the study finished. How could that be possible? Well, in 1984, there were two other researchers named Kesey and Corbett who found that every body seems to have a weight set point that controls our fat storage like a thermostat. That means if we are thinner than our inner weight set point, then our body turns on a few different processes to make us gain weight by increasing hunger, reducing metabolic rate, etc. And perhaps that is why losing weight by reducing calories, willpower, is possible, but then keeping it that weight off for a long time seems so difficult. It's because we first need to change our weight set point that is trying to keep us at a certain weight. So to summarize lesson two, the commonly accepted idea that losing weight is about cutting calories is based on several myths. The reality is that reducing calories in also reduces calories out, our basic metabolic rate. Another fact is different calories are metabolized or processed differently in the body, so it matters what kind of food we're eating. And another fact, it's hormones, not willpower, that controls many processes in our body related to calorie intake, expenditure, etc. Every body has a weight set point that works like a thermostat, trying to keep us at a certain weight. And that brings us to lesson number three, insulin causes obesity. It's persistently high insulin levels that cause insulin resistance, which causes obesity. So here is the core argument of the obesity code, that a high body weight set point is caused by insulin, and specifically a condition called insulin resistance in our bodies. So here are the key points that Dr. Fung talks about. First, what is insulin? Well, when we eat food, the carbohydrates in that food are broken down into glucose, which is a type of sugar that circulates in our blood. Then our pancreas organ releases a hormone called insulin, which delivers a message into our cells, telling them to use that blood sugar, glucose, for energy. So insulin is kind of like a key, which opens a door inside our cells to allow the glucose to enter. Without that key, the glucose stays in our blood and can be very damaging long term. A second key point, giving people insulin makes them gain weight. This has been proven in many studies involving diabetes patients, as insulin is the most common treatment for some types of diabetes, like type 1 diabetes, which is a more rare type of diabetes caused by insulin deficiency. By far the more common type of diabetes is called type 2 diabetes, and it usually develops over time as into adulthood, and that is a disease of insulin resistance. A third key point, insulin resistance is the reason people stay obese, according to Dr. Fung. This is when the body can still produce its own insulin, but for some reason, our cells have trouble accepting it or receiving the message from the insulin. As a result, more glucose stays in our blood, and that can have seriously negative effects on long-term health. So Dr. Fung argues that insulin resistance is the cause of a higher weight set point, which results in changes in our body, overeating, slowed metabolism, and more fat storage by the liver. And as another side point, the liver in our body, it turns that glucose from food into something called glycogen, and later that is turned into body fat in a process called de novo lipogenesis. That's basically how our body stores energy from food for the long term as fat storage. So what exactly causes insulin resistance? Dr. Fung says it's high levels of insulin that are persistent over time. So there are two parts to it. That first part is high levels of insulin. This is determined by what we eat. You see, all foods are composed of three major macronutrients. There are carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. Carbohydrates, or carbs, they're broken down into glucose in our bodies, which stimulates a strong insulin response. Proteins, they are not broken down into glucose, but they also stimulate insulin. Fats, on the other hand, increase insulin the least. So if the food we eat contains a lot of carbohydrates, then we will have higher levels of insulin than if our food has more fats. And the second part of it is persistent exposure to insulin. Insulin levels will remain elevated in our bodies when we're eating all the time. That includes snacking between meals and maybe eating from early morning to late at night. The key to reducing insulin resistance will be intermittent fasting, which we'll talk a lot more about near the end of this book summary. And as another side point, in the obesity code, there is actually a secondary hormone that causes obesity called cortisol, and that's also known as the stress hormone. We don't have time for all the details, but that means reducing stress is very important for weight loss. Stress reduction practices are active, like doing yoga, meditation, exercise, or getting a massage. It's not about passively sitting or consuming content, as many people may have been led to believe. Getting enough sleep is also essential for weight loss. There's another book called Why We Sleep, where the Stanford professor Matthew Walker says that a lack of sleep increases levels of a hormone called ghrelin that makes us feel hungry, while lowering levels of a hormone named leptin that makes us feel full. A study by the University of Chicago found that people ate 300 more calories every day when their sleep was restricted to 4 to 5 hours per night. So we should make sure that we're getting at least 7 hours of sleep each night. In that book, Walker's number one tip is to keep our bedtime constant. That means going to sleep and waking up at the same time each day. Also, to make sure that before bed that we avoid caffeine for several hours and avoid blue light from electronic screens for a couple hours. If you want to learn more, go listen to our summary of Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker on growth.me. So to summarize lesson 3, the main cause of obesity and high body weight set point is insulin resistance. Insulin is a hormone that helps us manage blood glucose, which comes from breaking down foods, especially carbohydrates. Insulin resistance is caused by high and persistent levels of insulin due to eating certain types of foods, like carbs, and eating all the time. And that leads us to lesson number 4, eat low-carb, healthy fats. To control our insulin levels and reduce fat, begin with eating natural and unprocessed fat. So how do we lower those insulin levels? We can begin by eating more of the kinds of foods that increase insulin the least, and those foods tend to be high in fat. By now, you've probably heard of keto or the ketogenic diet, which is heavy in fats. Some people take it to the extreme, believing it's healthy to eat bacon all day long. Dr. Fung doesn't go that far, but he does say that eating more of our calories from fat will make us healthier. The key is to avoid the sausage, but to eat more healthy and natural fats found in unprocessed whole foods or minimally processed foods, such as olive oil, nuts, seeds, fish, avocado, full-fat dairy, coconut oil, and some beef and pig fat. Be aware that there are multiple kinds of fat that Dr. Fung talks about and recommends. First, there are monounsaturated or polyunsaturated fat, which are found in some of those foods I just mentioned, like the olive oil, nuts, and fish. Those fats are part of the famously healthy Mediterranean diet, and most of the medical world agrees they're very healthy, which includes Ansel Keys, that doctor who began the low-fat craze decades ago. The second main type of fat Dr. Fung recommends are saturated fats, which are found in some of those other food examples like the animal fats, dairy, and coconut oil. And these remain controversial today in the medical world, but they're much less vilified than they were 10 or 20 years ago. Near the beginning of this summary, we talked about Dr. Fung's argument for why there was never any real scientific proof that saturated fats are bad, that they cause heart disease or obesity. So that's why he recommends that we eat them. What about protein? Well, Dr. Fung recommends that only 20 to 30% of our calories come from protein. While protein does not have the same effect on blood sugar as carbs do, it still increases insulin levels. How? Through other channels such as the incretin effect and the cephalic phase. Those are a bit complicated, so I can't go into the details, but the incretin effect is where stomach hormones stimulate our pancreas to release insulin, and the cephalic phase is a medical term. It's where the taste of food alone can stimulate insulin in our body in anticipation of digestion of food. So it's a bit too complicated to get into here, but just be aware that protein also can stimulate insulin, which is why he recommends we don't eat too much of it. Dr. Fung says eating meat does appear associated to weight gain, but dairy does not appear to be, according to studies. Now, in the Obesity Code, there are some fascinating sections of the book describing the biological mechanisms of how different foods are processed differently in our bodies. And those scientific explanations add a lot of credibility to Dr. Fung's nutrition recommendations. Unfortunately, in this summary, we simply can't go into those details because the amount of information would be overwhelming. But I highly recommend that you pick up the full book if you're finding this interesting. And Dr. Fung also has a popular YouTube channel with a lot of videos that you can watch to learn some more details. But to summarize lesson 4, fats increase insulin levels the least during and after a meal as compared to carbohydrates and proteins. So to lose weight, we should be eating more unprocessed or minimally processed foods that are high in fat, like olive oil, nuts, seeds, fish, avocado, full-fat dairy, etc. Next is lesson 5, increase fiber. Even foods high in carbohydrates can be healthy if they are whole and unprocessed. So not all foods that are high in carbohydrates are created equal. Some are much better for us than others because they don't increase blood glucose and insulin as much. Those better carbs tend to be high in fiber. What is fiber? It's a part of foods that passes through our body undigested, but it works to slow down how quickly our body digests food. In general, whole and unprocessed foods, like vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, are much higher in this fiber than processed foods, like juices, cereals, breads, candy bars. Because when food is processed, usually the fiber is removed to leave the carbs, like sugars. Why? Because the big food companies want to improve taste, and it helps to give a quick hit of sweetness. That's one reason why, for example, we can drink a lot of orange juice, but we can't eat that many whole oranges, because the oranges have a lot more fiber. There's actually a useful tool created by scientists called the glycemic index, which rates how strongly individual foods increase blood sugar. And that basically backs up this point that more processed foods are higher on the glycemic index, giving a quick hit of blood glucose and sweetness. So when we do eat carbs, we should make them whole foods that are unprocessed or minimally processed, and the more fiber the better. That generally means buying more food in the produce section and not in boxes that have a cartoon tiger on the front. In some places of the world, like the islands of Okinawa and Kitawa, the people famously have been eating a high-carb diet and they remain very healthy, but their traditional foods are unprocessed and whole, like sweet potatoes, so that's why they can remain healthy, eating so many carbs. Another point, vinegar also seems to help. Studies show that when carbs are eaten with vinegar, there's a lower response in glucose and insulin. And some common foods that include that combination include sushi rice, fries with vinegar, salad dressings, etc. Now there's another doctor named Michael Greger who offers a different point of view on nutrition, emphasizing an almost vegan way of eating that's high in whole plant foods and lower in fat. In his book, How Not to Die, he makes the case that our risk of most diseases is increased by eating more animal foods and highly processed foods. Dr. Greger shares a daily dozen checklist of foods he recommends that we eat daily, and that checklist includes beans, greens, berries, other fruits, whole grains, nuts and seeds, especially flax seeds. What do all those foods have in common? Lots of fiber. So if you want to hear that point of view on nutrition, take a look at our summary of How Not to Die by Dr. Michael Greger on growth.me. To summarize lesson 5, some carbohydrate foods are much healthier than others. The good ones tend to be unprocessed whole plant foods that are high in fiber, like broccoli, spinach, blueberries, whole grains, etc. In processed foods, the fiber tends to be removed for flavor, causing a stronger insulin response. Lesson 6 is to avoid added sugars. Processed foods tend to contain harmful added sugars and artificial sweeteners. So this lesson begins very easy. Avoid sugars. By now, we must all know sugar is bad for us, right? But here are a few key points that I learned from the Obesity Code. First, added sugars are often hidden in processed foods under alternative names such as sucrose, maltose, fructose, dextrose, etc. So we should keep an eye out for those names. In the recent past, people consumed a lot of sugar through drinks like Coca-Cola, but thankfully that trend appears to be reversing. If we want to find better snacks, those include fruits, dark chocolate, nuts, or seeds. Here's another good point. Fructose is an especially harmful sugar because it's only metabolized by our liver. So eating too much of that fructose can cause faster insulin resistance in our liver. You see, for a while, fructose was believed to be a healthier sugar because it didn't raise our blood sugar as much. But fructose can be found in both table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, often used to sweeten processed foods like soda. So we should probably avoid fructose even more than the other kinds of sugars. Another key point, Dr. Feng says artificial sweeteners should also be avoided. Now these have been assumed to be healthier because they don't have the same calories as sugar. And 42% of Coca-Cola sales are now diet drinks, so they've become quite popular. However, studies associate artificial sweetener consumption with increased risks of obesity and insulin resistance. The exact mechanisms of harm are not well understood yet. Perhaps the sweet taste itself is what stimulates insulin. But at the end of the day, I agree with one Dr. Pepino, who told a New York Times writer that sweetness should be consumed in moderation regardless of whether it has calories or not, end quote. Dr. Fung recommends allowing ourselves occasional indulgences of sugar or sweetness, especially at special occasions like birthdays and weddings. Now, in another book called Why We Get Fat, the journalist Gary Taubes echoes a similar message. He said, stay away from carbohydrate-rich foods, and the sweeter the food, or the easier it is to consume and digest, liquid carbohydrates like beer, fruit juices, and sodas are probably the worst, the more likely it is to make you fat, and the more you should avoid it. End quote. Can learn more about that explanation of obesity in the book Why We Get Fat by Gary Taubes. So to summarize lesson 6, we should eat little sugar, saving it for special occasions. Added sugars are hidden in processed foods under various names. Artificial sweeteners also have concerning effects in the body metabolism and should be avoided. Better to eat fruits, dark chocolate, nuts, cheese, etc. And the final lesson, number 7, intermittent fasting. The key to reducing insulin resistance is increased time between eating. Remember how insulin resistance is caused by both high and persistent levels of insulin? Well, now we'll talk about the second part, how to make sure our insulin levels are not persistently high. Since insulin goes up when we eat food, the key is to stretch out our time between eating. So here are some simplified tips from Dr. Fung. First, avoid snacks. Eat only 3 meals per day like most people did in the past, like before the 50s. That allows our insulin levels to decrease between meals. And since most snacks are highly processed foods anyway, there's a double benefit. A second tip, skipping breakfast is okay. It's a myth we always need to eat after waking up, especially if we're not hungry. A breakfast doesn't cause us to eat more later, and it's not required to have energy in the morning. A third tip is to regularly fast, meaning don't eat. In Dr. Fung's clinic, his patients usually fast 2 to 3 times per week for 24 to 36 hours each time. For example, that means a 24-hour fast could last from 6 p.m. one day to 6 p.m. the next day, so the patient would simply skip a couple of meals. They would finish eating 6 p.m. On one day, and they would go to sleep, and they would maybe skip breakfast and lunch again, and eat 6 p.m. on the second day. Here are just a couple of Dr. Fung's most important tips for fasting. Make sure you're drinking water or other types of fluids without calories like tea, coffee, or bone broth. Salt and water are very important to remain hydrated and avoid symptoms like headaches. Now, diabetics need to be very careful and keep their blood sugar under medical supervision. Many people feel resistant to fasting because it's become uncommon in modern society, but fasting has been important around the world to many cultures, traditions, and religions, and even today. Hundreds of millions of Muslims fast during Ramadan from sunrise to sunset, and plenty of other Buddhists and Christians also fast. Dr. Fung says, fasting is part of our animal nature, so we don't need to be afraid of it. Our body is designed to function well without food for periods of time. Otherwise, our species would have never survived. While fasting, the body switches from using short-term food energy to burning our long-term stored energy, also known as fat. And that means fasting doesn't lower our energy expenditure as much or in the same tiring way as chronic calorie restriction does. In my personal experiences with some short-term fasting, I've been surprised at how little hunger or tiredness that I felt. Sometimes there would be a short wave of tiredness during noon when I would need to take a short nap, but otherwise I felt more sharp, focused, and clear-headed. And I remember Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers of America, he wrote also about how eating a light diet has had mental benefits for him that were very similar, of being clear-headed. Now, there's a great scientific book on how to live longer called Lifespan, written by David Sinclair, who's a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School. And he also raves about the benefits of fasting for health and longevity. Sinclair says that we can live longer through other practices too, like physical exercise and exposure to cold temperatures. So what do all those practices have in common? Fasting, exercise, cold exposure? Well, they all expose our body to short-term stress, a kind of biological stress, not enough to damage us, but enough to activate certain biological pathways that actually makes us healthier over the long term. The key is that it's a shorter term and intermittent exposure. I mean, if we did not eat for months at a time, then eventually our bodies would break down. It would cause damage, like what happens to war prisoners. But if we are only occasionally fasting for a limited time, then that's actually restorative and healing to our bodies. It's a beneficial type of stress. You can learn more about those ideas in our summary of Lifespan by David Sinclair on growth.me. To summarize lesson 7, modern society teaches us we should be eating all the time, including snack times and big breakfasts. But Dr. Feng says that to break insulin resistance, we need to avoid persistently high insulin levels, and that means increasing the time between food by eliminating snacks completely, skipping breakfast if we're not hungry, and also fasting 1 to 2 times per week for 24 to 36 hours. Okay, so let's finish up with 3 quick practical action steps for how we could apply this book to our lives. Action step number 1, write down 3 foods you could eat that are low on the glycemic index. So on the written version of this summary, there's a link to a useful list of foods that are low on the glycemic index. Those are foods that don't spike the blood sugar and insulin as much. Some examples include chickpeas, mushroom, onions, cashews, etc. Action step number 2 is to check the ingredients label of 1 food you have at home. I mean, we probably all have food at home that's processed or packaged. So one of the best habits that we can get into is checking the nutrition labels before we buy food. If we look at the ingredients and we don't understand the name of an ingredient, then we should be Googling it. And we should especially watch out for that added sugar that comes in so many different names. So we should Google the names to find out if it's some kind of sugar. Action step number 3 is to avoid buying unhealthy food in the store. Now, this nutrition tip is probably the most simple yet useful one that I ever learned. If we don't have junk food lying around at home, then we won't eat it and no willpower is required. So if we do want to have an occasional snack, like a cheat meal or a cheat snack once a week or so, it's much better to buy a very small package and not have extra junk food lying around the home. So avoid buying extra unhealthy food in the stores. Okay, so I hope this book summary was useful, and I'll see you in the next one.